You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Good evening. I'm Karen Lissakers, the director of the Revenue Watch Institute. And I'm very pleased to welcome you all here this evening for a very interesting presentation and discussion of getting a better deal from the extractive sector, concession negotiations in Liberia 2006-2008. Much of the debate around the so-called resource curse focuses on poor governance as the proximate cause. But those of us who work in this field of trying to help countries maximize their economic benefit of their natural resource wealth know that it's not just a question of bad governance, but often it's also a matter of bad deals. That countries have entered into concessions, licensing terms, contracts that are in fact very unbalanced and give the country a much lower return than it actually should get from its resource wealth. Number of governments, particularly during the recent boom, commodity boom, have realized this fact and have begun to take a good hard look at the terms of the deals they've entered into or their predecessors enter into. Perhaps the most comprehensive effort in this direction has been that of Liberia, the new government that came into power in January 2006 after a period of protracted war over and around resources, began a comprehensive review of concessions. And also renegotiation, had successful renegotiations of some very large contracts. President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf believed that reviewing the experience of this first stage of its contracts restructuring would serve as a guide. The experience from that early stage could serve as a guide for future negotiations and offer some lessons for her team. Revenue Watch Institute was very pleased to support the examination of that experience and summary, because we think that Liberia's experience has very important lessons for other countries that are already in the process of reviewing their extractive contracts and concessions and policy framework, some of which we are helping, like Sierra Leone, or countries that governments that will enter into this process in future years. We've invited a panel tonight to talk about the report and to talk about the broader issues that it raises. We have with us, first of all, Mr. Roger Call, who is the lead author of the report and who served as a senior legal advisor to the Office of the President of Liberia in this process. He was part of the standing team engaged to support the government's review and negotiation of Liberia's major concession agreements and commercial contracts. Roger has a 20-year career as a lawyer with major Fortune 500 corporations and the nonprofit organization AfriCare. Sitting to Roger's right is the Honorable Minister O. Natty B. Davis, who is the Minister of State and head of the Secretariat of the Liberia Reconstruction and Development Committee, and who, of course, has both participated and observed the renegotiation process. Ms. Davis worked as a senior policy advisor and consultant in the former National Transitional Government of Liberia. He's worked with UNAIDS, the Africa Comprehensive HIV Partnership, the EU, the International Labour Organization in Liberia and Botswana. He has also researched and presented papers on government, fiscal, and monetary performance, private sector development in Liberia, and enterprise development. He is the former Secretary General of the Liberia Chamber of Commerce. We also have with us two experts who have been involved in other concession negotiations, not specifically Liberia. One such organization is the International Senior Lawyers Project, which was a major legal advisor to the government of Liberia. Mr. Jeffrey Wood is a member of the International Senior Lawyers Project with considerable experience in Liberia, although not with the negotiations that are discussed in the report. He's a retired partner with Debevoise Plimpton, an advisor to the International Senior Lawyers Project. And he was involved in ISLP's preparation of model mining concessions agreements. He specializes in corporate finance and project finance transactions, as well as cross-border financing and complex domestic and international projects. He has a lot of experience, which is probably coming in handy now, with Chapter 11 bankruptcy debt restructurings, including Chrysler in 1980 and Delta Airlines in 2006. Professor Peter Rosenblum is a professor at Columbia University Law School, where he holds the Leif Cabraser Clinical Professorship of Human Rights Law. He was a human rights officer in Geneva for the office that was the precursor to the UN's High Commission for Human Rights, and also program director of the International Human Rights Law Group. Peter Rosenblum has worked actively in Africa, and especially in the DRC, including in contracts, resource concessions, reviews. Peter also works very, and his law school clinic works very closely with the Revenue Watch Institute, including on a major study of extractive industry contracts. Roger Call is going to kick off with the discussion of the report that he played such a large part in writing. Please, sir.
Thank you, Karin. I'd like to start by thanking Revenue Watch and OSI for hosting this event today. I'd especially like to thank Karin and Antoine for, and the rest of my friends at Revenue Watch for making it possible for me to be here today. Before I get going, I do want to say that I'm here in my personal capacity, and the views and opinions I express are my own and do not reflect the position of any organization that I may be currently affiliated with. So, having given that disclaimer, what I wanted to do was dive right in by asking a number of questions that I'm hoping will be useful in the discussion today. I think the initial question given this report is, did Liberia get better terms as a result of its efforts to renegotiate its largest foreign investment contracts at the time, between 2006 and 2008, namely the ArcelorMittal contract and the Firestone contract? And I think the answer to that has to be yes. The country certainly did get better terms. In the ArcelorMittal contract, there were over 30 improvements, including improvements to royalty calculations, income taxation, and import duty terms in the Mittal contract. The renegotiation brought about the cancellation of a tax holiday that originally existed in the prior contract. Corporate governance and sovereignty issues were addressed. And there were social benefit and additional environmental protections, as well as what has now become a staple in the Liberian extractive industry negotiation process, an upfront payment. Mittal was the first contract that we saw that in. In Firestone, there were additional gains as well, on transfer pricing, there was a degree of transparency that we were able to negotiate in the Firestone contract that didn't exist before, tying the prices that Firestone sells its latex to international market indices. There were other taxes and duties that had been waived that we were able to renegotiate and bring back into the contract. And Firestone committed to do in the contract what, in fairness to the company, was already doing, which was working on value-added manufacturing and social benefits. The process also shortened the contract term to something that was, in the government's opinion, far more reasonable. So if we do agree that Liberia was able to get better terms through the process, the question then is, how did Liberia do that? And the report spends quite a bit of time looking at that. The background and history to this is interesting because the new administration, while it came to power in 2006 with the announcement that it was going to review all major contracts, did inherit an ongoing contract review process that brought with it international legitimacy. Back in 2003, coming out of the peace accord that brought Liberia's conflict to an end, was an agreement by the National Transitional Government and its international partners called GMAP. And under GMAP, one of the things under GMAP was a requirement that Liberia review its contracts. As a result of that process, which went on into the first few months of the new government, both Firestone and Mittal were flagged as contracts for review. So the government, the new government, the current government, inherited, if you like, a process that legitimized its review of those two contracts with support from the international community. Having said that, though, there was still significant risk with undertaking those negotiations. The new government inherited a country that was in dire need of jobs. Coming out of the post-conflict environment, there were high expectations of the democratically elected government. And so there were a number of people in different quarters that were concerned that going after Mittal almost immediately after coming into office may not have been the smartest thing to do. So it required some political will and courage to initiate those negotiations. What the report explores is the leadership style of the government, in particular of the president, in being able to navigate the concerns from certain quarters about proceeding with the renegotiations, while motivating her team to take on those negotiations. The other thing that the report talks about, and on the face of it, it seems simple, is the teamwork and cooperation that the government agencies involved in the process displayed. That's not something to be taken for granted, has been my experience now as I've worked with other countries in Africa. And I think that was part of the reason Liberia succeeded. The ministers and agencies involved were able to find a common purpose despite differing experiences and different points of views about what was in the best interest of the country. They found a way to work together, and that played a significant role, I think, in Liberia's success. Liberia is also fortunate to be able to get external technical assistance from leading international experts, and the government was able to successfully integrate those experts in the negotiation process. So while the Liberians remained firmly in control of the negotiations and made their own decisions, they were able to involve the outside experts and use their skills and technical know-how to inform their decision-making in a way that I think benefited the country. These these negotiations are often much longer than people take much longer than people anticipate or expect. They certainly take much longer than the public has patience for often, and they take much longer than politicians tend to commit results. And so often governments find themselves midstream in the process, and they have to develop a commitment to stay with it. And in Liberia's case, being strapped for resources, they also have to develop a commitment to spend the resources and time it need this sort of negotiation requires. Liberia did that in this case. I think also important to Liberia's success in terms of the gains are the companies that we're talking about, both ArcelorMittal and Firestone. Both of those companies, I think, were more interested in getting the resources Liberia has, in the case of Firestone, the renewable resource, and in the case of Mittal, the iron ore, than, say, going to arbitration or looking to get money damages. They both are companies, interestingly enough, that have integrated supply chains. And so in the case of ArcelorMittal, the mines in Liberia were captive mines supplying their global needs, and they were working to establish, if you like, their supply of iron ore. And in the case of Firestone, Bridgestone, sort of contrary to other rubber companies, was moving towards making sure that it had a constant supply of natural rubber for its tires as well. So I think those issues played into the willingness of the companies to go along with the process. And finally, as Karin mentioned, these negotiations happened at a different economic time. And I think that was also a factor in the success here. The existing economic conditions allowed for some of the gains that that were made. I think the more interesting question is, do better terms translate into a better deal for the country? So clearly, the contracts are better than they were before the process of renegotiation. But does that necessarily mean a better deal for Liberia? And I think the short answer is it may. The verdict is out. The government is working hard to do, I believe, what it needs to do to make sure these contracts translate into better deals for the country. But there are a number of steps that are more medium and long-term steps that are required to ensure the results are maximized. I think the most important part of this is that creating an infrastructure to support the gains that were realized in these negotiations is going to be the key. And what do I mean by infrastructure? Well, first, the revision and harmonization of the legal and policy frameworks that support these contracts. Very often, these contracts, because there's an attempt to maximize the gain to the country and set a more equitable distribution of the resources coming from the negotiations, outpace the current legal system or certain portions of the current laws that apply. And so as the government makes advances in these contracts, the key is to come back and incorporate those advances in the laws, whether they're tax laws or mining laws or procurement laws. And the government of Liberia is working on that right now. The other thing that needs to be done is an effective monitoring and compliance process needs to be put in place so that the government and civil society and the public at large can hold both the government and the companies to the terms of these agreements. That is something the government recognizes, and there's currently active discussion within the government about how to bring about an effective monitoring and compliance unit and set of mechanisms. One of the things, or the report talks about two things that I think will help other stakeholders outside of the government engage in the process of monitoring compliance. The report discusses the need for formalizing the process for civil society and the affected communities to provide to be consulted as part of the negotiation process or the contract review process. That was something that was done informally in Mittal and in Firestone. But I think the government recognizes that it would be better if there was a formal process for engaging with civil society and affected communities to get their input and to do these consultations prior to getting into negotiation. The other thing that Liberia does, which is, I wouldn't say unique, but certainly distinguishes the country, is that it makes these contracts public. They are publicly available. However, being publicly available and being easily accessible is a challenge. And there are a number of reasons for that, including just a resource question. But again, that's something the government's looking at and attempting to address, making these contracts easily accessible so that affected communities, civil society, interested parties, Liberian citizens can have access to these terms and understand what the government's committed to. And finally, last but not least, to make all of this happen in terms of making sure Liberia gets a better deal, Liberia will have to continue to work, and the government will have to continue to work on developing its capacity to monitor and ensure compliance, to manage these contracts, to ensure that amendments and changes get negotiated in the way that they should, and that as experts move on to other countries, that Liberia has the ability to, through its own people, manage the contracts and the resources associated with these contracts. It'll have to continue to work on developing its own capacity. Capacity in the government, the report talks about that, but also in terms of recruiting both within Liberia and from the Liberian diaspora, and then sort of long-term making sure that the educational system provides a class of people interested in the extractive industries, interested in the concession negotiation activity of the government, and available to support that. So, in conclusion, what can other countries learn, African states learn from the Liberian experience? And I'm sure that's what we'll talk about here. I offer this, that the negotiation process is complex. There are many factors that go into making that went into making the Liberian experience successful. Currently, certainly the current economic situation is a different climate than which these contracts were negotiated. But I would argue that, unlike some, that this may be a good time for some countries to begin that process. At the end of the day, though, it really does depend on the companies involved in the process and their commitment to exploiting the natural resources and the country, not exploiting the country, but their commitment to the country, or their willingness to either get out of the business if the costs are too high. I'll leave it at that, and we can pick up that discussion as the rest of the panelists come in. Thank you.
Thank you, Raja. Minister Davis, you have participated in this process and seen it from a somewhat different perspective than Raja, and we look forward to your comments. I think it would be particularly interesting if you could include some remarks about the domestic politics of this renegotiation. And to what extent the government felt pressure or not. And secondly, the degree to which you felt that international actors like the international financial institutions, the World Bank, African Development Bank, others, and individual donor governments were supportive of this process or were wary of it.
Well, thank you. I really don't want to really talk much. I'd like to be able to respond to some of your questions and your inquiries. I think Roger has touched on a good bit of it, but also let me take the opportunity to extend my greetings to all here and also to acknowledge, as has been done, and you know, usually in particular government political circles, the first person says greetings, the next person says greetings, and the next person says greetings, and that takes up all of the time. But we do have to extend our appreciation to Revenue Watch, to OSI, to ISLP, and to many, many of the people, to the LRDC support team that supported this effort, to some of the other people who have worked along with us to have gotten us where we are. Usually by the time you reach to something like this, a lot of people have put in a lot of work to get there, and usually by the time I'm involved, when something like this reach, I've already moved on to the next project, and I let a lot of the others deal with all of the issues, and which is some of what I have done, to be very honest with you, is to have moved on to the next phase, which is that next phase, as Raja had mentioned, building capacity deeper within the Liberian government and the civil service to actually, for us to move. All of the negotiations that took place have been taking place with the lead and with the actual input of a lot of political appointees. What happens when those people leave government? What happens when Ellen Sirleaf appoints someone else in finance or NIC or whatever the case may be? We don't have the depth down below to be able to manage some of the other negotiation process going forward. So for me, again, was to really look at some of the lessons learned in this work that was done, but then now it's also now, how do we build capacity within government that it's a lot deeper and it's a lot more sustained and sustainable, because we do have still a lot more concessions and contracts and things to be able to negotiate on behalf of the government. Secondly is the monitoring and compliance capability. It's great where you spend many hours, many days, you bring in all kinds of experts that have been able, for instance, on the Mitau, that worked with us from not just ISLP, but that worked with us from Columbia University, that actually took the time to look at the investment proposal, the ROI, all of those kinds of things there. And we've got now a good deal. But then we don't have the capacity to monitor whether or not the concession agreement is being adhered to. We don't have all of the compliance capabilities that we've made issue of, you know, the revenue side, the production side, all of the social benefits. You know, how are we dealing with those compliance things? So my interaction now with many of the partners working along with UNDP and others is to begin to see how are we also building on that. The experience specifically from this activity was very good, and again, I'd like to listen to some of your questions and respond to your questions. I'm sure that there are many. I'm also trying to develop now to see if I can find funding to do a case study on the LRDC in the 3 years of the LRDC, because again, by utilizing that framework early on by the president, we've been able to really get a number of things done by working truly in the spirit of partnership and taking advantage of all of the goodwill that has been out there for us, and how we've been able to kind of coordinate all of that and get it to work. So we're hoping that we can do that also as a case study that will be able to show lessons learned from developing partnerships. Raja mentioned what was critical in the whole exercise was the leadership of the president, but that has been critical in the entire recovery process of Liberia. I've pointed out as I've met in different forums, and we've talked about state building and peace building and the whole recovery process of a country that's been in conflict, and what are some of the critical elements of beginning now to deal with putting that country back together. And one of the things that I found throughout all of that is the critical role of leadership. And Ellen Sirleaf has provided that. Again, as I've shared with her, and part of my own focus, though, is to how do we transition from strong leadership into institutions? And that's where we need to go as a country. We need to get to the point where we have been able to restore institutions, where we have been able to rebuild those institutions. It's a challenge. There are a number of graphs that sometimes I tend to work with to just kind of show people, to give them an idea of the context of things. I just got a new one that came that showed civil service, the current current situation of the civil service in terms of the pay scale. And even though that graph is not here, but one of the things that it shows that out of the 16 grades of this in the civil service that existed in 1980, the top pay was $19,000 at the top level. Today, that top pay is just about $6,000, and that was 1980 dollars. That gives you an appreciation of where, and then therefore, what are you dealing with as far as getting the capacity that's capable, that's in government, to be able to get a lot of things done. So many, many challenges. Let me just respond to the two questions that you've asked about. One is the domestic environment and the support from the other players in the international community. I would say the support from the other players in the international community, first and foremost, of course, was the peace process. And what the peace process did do was to lay a framework for us to have a certain legitimacy to be able to go back and renegotiate contracts. And so that was critical. That provided, within that time frame, the 2 years of the transition government. And within the 2 years of the transition government, under support or the interventions of GMAP, it provided the framework to say, okay, all contracts that were entered into during the transition government will be subject to review. And again, because regardless of what kind of government, whether it's a good government, it's a bad government, whatever it is, once a contract has been entered into, it is a legal document. And therefore, even as another government comes in and asks for renegotiating, the company can say no. The organization can say no. We have a legal document that was entered into by a government of Liberia, and we're going to stick with those terms. And we could have gone to court, and that whole process could have been dragged out. And so by having that framework in place, it provided the first basis for being able to engage with those partners to say, well, okay, during this time you did enter with the transitional government. You knew that you could have waited, since you knew what the peace process was and you knew there would be an elected government coming in, and you had the opportunity to wait. Fortunately, we didn't go to court, and we had the opportunity to really work our way through that. And with the support of the international community, particularly the World Bank, the members in the U.S. government and so forth, we were able to find the space to engage with both ArcelorMittal, the leadership of ArcelorMittal and Firestone, to go through the renegotiation process. On the domestic side, I think there were actors on, you know, both sides. I mean, you know, some people felt, why do you want to go through? Why do you want to come in and renegotiate what has been decided on by a transitional government? Because the transitional government technically was the legal entity at the time, particularly when these contracts had to then go for ratification. All concession agreements are responsible to go for ratification to the legislature. And by so doing, fortunately, we had the opportunity to show how much those agreements had been improved upon. And so we didn't have, on the domestic side, I say there was more broad support from most of the actors, even at the stage where we had to engage with the national legislature to get those concession agreements approved. Overall, I think the review and the document provides a wonderful opportunity for Liberia to be able to share her experience with other developing countries, not just on the continent, but in other different development space throughout. We consider ourselves very fortunate to have been able to undertake this and also be able to document it. We do know that even within our region, Guinea, Sierra Leone, there's a lot lessons learned that can be utilized from here. I had the opportunity recently last year to meet with some of my colleagues in DR Congo and again share with them some of the experiences that we have had, and they have a large set of activities ahead of them that will be valued at billions and billions of dollars, and the benefit that could accrue to the people of Congo. And so taking some of the lessons learned from here, utilizing the expertise of others and trying to really negotiate good deals for their country are things that we are happy to be able to share and play a role in. That's a lot of work, as Roger has said, that needs to be done. We are happy that both the UNDP and also the African Development Bank are now developing programs to support countries, particularly African countries, in their contract negotiations on concession and extractive industries and a number of those other sectors. We believe there is much work to be done in there in terms of building the capability of the various countries that will be going through this. And there's still a lot of work that needs to be done in Liberia. And so we intend to take full advantage of these programs. I think Roger and others can share with you that once I see those opportunities to take advantage of those programs, I really go after them. So we intend to take full advantage of the programs and the benefit, the additional benefits that can accrue to Liberia. I think let me stop there because I look forward to really being able to respond to many of your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Minister Davis. Jeffrey Wood, when I introduced you, I mentioned the International Senior Lawyers Project, as did the minister, of course. But we haven't really explained what it is, and perhaps you can tell us what ISLP is and why lawyers who can make $800 or $900 an hour representing the Mittal Steels and the Firestones of this world would give their time for free to help the government of Liberia or Sierra Leone or others. What drives that process? What contribution do you think it makes to helping countries resolve the resource curse, as it were? And also, if you have any particular remarks about the Liberia situation and experience specifically, we welcome them. Thank you.
Thank you. That was a curveball I wasn't expecting. I would say almost my boss in ISLP is back in the back here, and I'm a little afraid of being a second guess. And I must admit that my involvement in ISLP is a little different because I'm a retired lawyer. So I either get paid nothing for chopping wood in the country or get nothing for helping Liberia, and helping Liberia is a lot more fun. But the point of the project really is, I think in many ways, that in the way law firms are organized, it's almost more difficult for very senior lawyers to do pro bono work here in the United States than it is for younger lawyers. The big pressure for pro bono work here, as I have seen it, is in all sorts of representation of people without economic substance who need legal help in relatively small matters. ISLP gives you the chance to go to a place like Mongolia or the Congo or Liberia and work on the other side of the same major transactions you might have been working on as a lawyer, as a senior lawyer in a law firm. It's very exciting. It's also got the gratification of at least seeming, if you're used to doing big deals, more important, although I don't know that it is, but it seems more important than doing a litigation on a landlord-tenant case in Jersey City, for example. So that I think that's why they get a lot of people interested in it and willing to volunteer. And just the fact that I think if you've spent any time doing international work, the discrepancy between this country and what countries have in Africa and their resources and their ability to defend themselves, assist themselves, is so great that you watch some of these negotiations and what's going on, and basically it's fairly hard not to feel a little guilty about it. So all of those, I think, combine to make people happy to try to make time for ISLP and other similar projects in which experienced senior lawyers volunteer their time. And Gene Berman, who's the director of ISLP, is sitting back there in the back. I'm embarrassing her now, but she will be happy to meet with any of you individually and tell you where I was wrong in that description. As to Liberia's experience in the Mittal and Firestone deals, I can't tell you too much because my involvement in Liberia started after those renegotiations were finished. I first started working in Liberia and just when the Firestone Agreement went to the legislature in February of last year. What I've been doing is trying to work mostly with the Ministry of Mines, Lands, and Energy on mining-relating issues. The problem of creating regulations to basically implement legislation. Liberia passed the mining law in 2000 during the Taylor government. It's not an impossible law. It's possible to work under it, but it is totally vague and has no detail in it to help the ministry administer the mining sector. And as a result, they've been having to do it based on their own personal experience and flying by the seat of their pants, and they haven't had time or the resources to acquire sufficient outside help. So what I have been doing is drafting exploration regulations, trying to help them come up with standardized contracts, starting with the Mittal contract, and trying to develop that further, push it in some ways into something which provides an easier administrative vehicle, which will tie itself back in to the regulations we're preparing so that is open for negotiation within the scope of a contract is somewhat less. Today, without any details in the law, sort of everything seems to be open for negotiation. The more you can get things down in a set of coherent regulations, even if they're not complete, even if they're not, don't cover everything, the more you can do that, though, the less ability the foreign operating company has to come in and seek special treatment because you can say, look, this is what the rules say. And the easier it is for senior officials in a ministry to focus on important issues. And this isn't going to be true just for mining. It's going to be true for any of the ministries which engage in negotiations with foreign countries. You don't want to have to start from a clean slate each time. That's an invitation both to one-off situations which you then can't administer, and also an invitation to some of the more unpleasant things that sometimes go on in this kind of environment in countries that don't have well-developed standards of governance, and from what I've seen, sometimes and even ones that do have better developed standards of governance. As to some of the recommendations that are made, I have a couple of observations that I'd be curious to hear what other people think. The whole compliance question I find a really troubling one because a lot of the compliance issues, at least in the extractive industries, are environmental issues. Most countries are trying to develop EPAs of their own, if you will. I would think that you would want to have your administration of the environmental aspects of all of the contracts vested in an agency that has environmental responsibility rather than an agency that has overall financial
and contract monitoring responsibility. I haven't discussed this with Roger, so I'll be curious to know what his view is, but that's one area, one kind of area which is of concern to me. I'm not sure how, whether your central area, the kind of secretariat that they talk about in their report, is the right vehicle to be monitoring the social kinds of issues that are in these contracts, the compliance by the foreign operators with the their social undertakings to develop communities. So that's one area that kind of puzzles me. Another area that has struck me in all of this, and because this is my first experience from the government side, is how much harder it is to negotiate from the government side than it is from the corporate side. I've represented corporations negotiating in not Africa, but other less developed countries around the world, very large projects. And there's a huge difference in the focus that the two sides bring to the process. You may have, in a corporate negotiation, you may have a treasury guy, you may have in a very large mining company, a human relations community development person, you'll have a mining operating guy, and you'll have somebody from corporate legal. But they are all part of one organization. The politics within that organization may exist, but it's much more hierarchical, much more governed, and people are much more focused. When you're trying to get senior ministers in a government, particularly a government in a frail country, to work together on a contract in the way Roger describes, it's very hard, in a sense, to get them to spend the time and energy to do so, because there is no single unity of purpose in, particularly in frail governments. People are worried about their own personal situation. They're worried about their own ministry's competition for resources. They're worried about what their next appointment is going to be, which may depend upon the favor of somebody other than the current chief executive officer. It's a very different environment, and it requires, I am discovering, very different skills in trying to serve them and represent them. So that in itself raises questions about how you staff and how you structure this kind of operation, because you can't have, in a country that's trying to do a large number of concessions, have the president play the role that she did in Mittal and Firestone, as Roger is quite clearly makes quite clear in at the end of his presentation. I don't yet see quite how you create that focus. I think the central staffing element, I'm much more optimistic about the role of a central staffing element in the negotiation of these contracts than I am in the administration of them, where I'm somewhat skeptical. Maybe that's enough for the moment. Now, let me make one more observation, because I'm curious to hear other people's reactions to it later. And that is that the task of building capacity is one that leaves me scratching my head, because in a country like Liberia, and I suspect a number of the other African countries that are either post-conflict situations or just desperately poor, there is no second tier of people who have the time to be trained. The only people who are making the decisions and who are taking the actions and who have the experience to take the actions are the first level people, and they're too busy trying to keep things afloat to stop and be, quote, trained. And that's a real challenge, I think. Raj's report talks about scholarships for younger people, sending them overseas for training. That requires a huge amount of resources if you look at the cost of training individuals in terms of the total amount of funds. I'm talking too quietly. Requires a huge amount of resources in relation to the total amount of funds available to the Liberian government, which makes programs like that almost dependent upon the generosity of third parties, which is not a healthy way to run a long-term program. So that's sort of my observations. They're a little disconnected, but I hope they're useful.
Thank you very much. Well, your last comments about the challenge of capacity building is a nice lead-in to Professor Rosenblum. So Peter, it would be useful if you would give some comments on the capacity building challenge and how governments like Liberia that come out of such a difficult history, which alas is not unique for resource-rich countries, or the DRC where you're active now, can build a cadre, develop a cadre of people in the government and in the society generally who can assume the long-term responsibility of not just negotiating, but also ensuring compliance with the government's policies and laws in terms of contracts. Secondly, you've been very active in the DRC and its concessions review process. And I wonder if there are particular aspects of Liberia's experience that you think are particularly pertinent to the situation that the DRC, which is coming along later, is facing now.
Thank you very much, and thanks to Revenue Watch for the support over time and the relationship we've been able to build and build with others. I follow Raja around the world and try and get on panels with him. One of these days I'll actually be as organized as he is, and I'll have the PowerPoint presentations that he carries around in his back pocket ready to whip out for these various events. And Natty as well. I mean, it's great to be at the table with you. Let me start in thinking about the second question by saying how, in a way, painful it is, the painful pleasure of recognizing the power of what's gone on in Liberia and the absence of many of the key elements in other countries that have, as a result, led to frustration in other places. It could be that Liberia has gotten by the skin of its teeth. It could be that history for a change has been kind to Liberia and given it the right people at the right moment because of the prices in the commodities sector, because of the change of government. But as I listened and thought about it again, and we've talked about these issues together on many occasions, I would note and stress the international support and the marvelous way in which Natty characterized it. The GMAT process meant that there was legitimacy, not actually that there was a process, because I don't think that the international community particularly helped Liberia with the review of contracts. Those of us who watched the GMAT process from the inside weren't terribly impressed with what went on there. But the legitimacy that it gave, so that when President Sirleaf said, and we're going to fast-track these two contracts, meant that it was very hard for others to stand against it. Natty said kind things about the United States. I remember that when we first tried to get the United States to talk about the Mittal contract, there was nobody home. The U.S. had actually lobbied for that contract to be approved and was really not interested in discussing the revision or renegotiation, even though it should have been on the table along with the other contracts. Political will, the role that President Johnson Sirleaf played was quite phenomenal. There are elements in the report that are great in terms of the richness of the organizing of moving forward. I see that Raja didn't want to talk too much about some of the politics beforehand that enabled all of this to happen. What I remember was reading about Ellen Sirleaf going to the UK, and somehow or another she and Lakshmi Mittal met up, and I've always been curious about what happened in that meeting and how much that was responsible for getting Mittal to come to the table. Because our own experience was that we had worked with an NGO in Liberia that had published our review of the Mittal contract. And Mittal's response was, get lost. We have a contract. Now, I'm going to come back to why they couldn't simply push the process away. But the international support, the political will, the legitimacy that gave, the momentum that helped to create when you had a president who was willing to push forward, and then the internal coordination, even as hard as it was. I've heard Raja discuss this on other occasions, the herding of the sheep, the working with different ministries, the getting everybody to the table, extremely difficult, the investment of time that went into that, but effective. It was done. It was pulled off. The effective use of experts. This process was never driven by outsiders, but outsiders were extremely well used in the process. Their services were consumed by able consumers who knew what to do with them. And the ability to commit the time. Nobody has patience in government. If you tell them in advance how long it's going to take, perhaps they would all have run away from it, but they took it on and they engaged in it. Now, that was a list of five things, none of which was present in the DRC when government changed in the Democratic Republic of Congo in 2006. And what should have been a similar opportunity for rethinking and renegotiating was on the table. But even before I get to that, I want to say a couple of things as a question about the Mittal contract and the process, because I believe that even with all of that, it still wouldn't have happened in Liberia without other events and people willing to push and some other coincidences, at least things that I saw or I thought I saw at that time, which would be interesting to know about. Now, I said we reviewed that contract. Well, there's a long history, and most of the people in this room probably know it, of secrecy in mining contracts. And it's pretty hard to explain, actually. When you get a hold of these and you look at them and you see that they're largely like treaties in many ways. They bind governments, they restrict the governments in what it can do in a way that Western governments have refused to do in decades. Restricts their ability in public policy to change their laws in the environment, in labor, or in other areas oftentimes. It allocates decisions to foreign bodies under foreign laws. So the Mittal contract was disclosed. It was supposed to have been voted on by the parliament. It actually was voted on by the parliament in Liberia, but the parliament never saw the text of it. The law said they should vote on it, but they only saw a summary of something that really didn't even describe the contract. The contract was leaked, and people like us saw it, and others saw it, and at that point, there was something marvelous, which was it was a really lousy contract. It was badly typed. It had grammatical errors. It was governed by a law that doesn't exist. It was governed by the contract law of the United Kingdom. It had problems that, once they were exposed to light, necessitated some level of response. And in fact, the first step was that exposing to light and being able to point to some of the horrors. Now, we had the Mittal contract and the Firestone contract. We couldn't say the same thing about the Firestone contract, which was actually pretty well drafted in many ways, and by people who were much more sensitive in the appearances to the concerns of the Liberian population. So you couldn't just embarrass them in the same way that you could in the case of the Mittal contract. So Mittal had a very hard time justifying what they had done with a contract that was governed by a law that didn't exist, with provisions that were vague and extensive. And that was in terms of the steps of exposing, of pushing the process. Mittal did resist at that point, and then you had President Johnson Sirleaf reaching out to Mittal, putting together the team, being able to move forward, and being able to then leverage so many of these other elements that I've referred to that were in place, and making things to make things work. But I think that's part of the story. Now, one of the tragedies, and this relates to what we've also heard about capacity, but in this case a tragedy that worked for Liberia, was that many of the worst things that we read in that Mittal contract turned out to have been boilerplate language that came out of the file cabinets of the Ministry of Land, Mines, and Energy in Liberia. Those weren't things that Mittal had asked for. Those were things that the government of Liberia had given. So the capacity problem, it turned out perhaps many of those things that we saw were not so much corruption and contortions and distortions, but rather this horrendous lack of capacity. And that's something that we see in so many of these agreements. We don't know at the end of the day whether the continued secrecy in many of the contracts around Africa and elsewhere is to hide incapacity or hide corruption, whether it's simply embarrassment at what's going to be exposed, or whether it's the more specific embarrassment of individuals who were able to gain money. In terms of building capacity, I'll just say a few things also about some of the risks that we know are there. There is capacity in the Congo. I've met a lot of people with a lot of capacity. They're many of them work in government ministries, but they're not paid. That's not where they earn their keep. It's been the industry that's kept those people afloat and actually kept some of them in government ministries because they're very useful there. There are people who, in terms of capacity, that are around, and some of them are in civil society. I think that one thing we need to do is to leverage the transparency, is in opening up the spaces to open up the commentary and the analysis. When we first analyzed the Mittal contract, I really feel like we were little kids in law school, reading and using a template that Amnesty International had modeled for human rights analysis of contracts. Later, we read the analysis that was done by the International Senior Lawyers Project, and we were blown away because we had essentially missed all the important economic issues. Small detail. We've learned since then, and others can as well. But it's a process of opening up the trunk, seeing what's inside for the first time in decades, understanding that there's not necessarily some great mystery about these contracts. Not necessarily, there aren't necessarily state secrets. There typically aren't, or business secrets for that matter, which are typically in other places or can be easily removed. And that in getting access to them, that's the first step also towards extending the analysis, and understanding that there's a lot of practice that is certainly not best, but has been able to evolve, especially in Africa, in the mining and oil sector, because it's taken place under this cloak of secrecy. And then in developing the capacity, ensuring that companies are willing to accept the expert assistance. I said that the Congo had nothing in that list that I gave. The international assistance was there. The ISLP and others was ready to give it. Even without the political will, even with the international problems that were there, there were lawyers ready to go and ready to give it. And at the end of the day, it was a country that didn't know how to use it and was embarrassed to accept it, and so wasn't even willing to employ the assistance offered in order to bolster its own capacity, and just went through the entire so-called renegotiation process without any outside experts, volunteer or paid, in order to assist in that process. Well, that's the tragic side of it. I shouldn't keep talking because I've already gone on too long as to what other elements are that could be out there, but I think the Liberian story has a great deal to borrow from. I'm fearful that at this moment there are very few states that are willing to do so.
Just one clarification. When you were...
First things first.
One clarification. When you were talking about the Mittal contract, you were talking about the original Mittal contract that was done... prior to the renegotiation.
No, I was talking about the later. Right. I'm kidding. Of course, I was talking about the original contract. No. We were pleased to help in the denunciation process that could bring in the renegotiation.
Thank you all for these very illuminating comments. We're going to open the discussion now for questions and comments from the floor. But before we do so, I just wanted to. Mentioned that there is a second author of this report, and that is our Revenue Watch Institute's own senior economist, Antoine Oti, who is sitting back there, and maybe you should stand up, Antoine. So, the floor is open. If you want to ask a question or make a comment, please go up to a microphone and identify yourself before you pose your question or make your comment.
And why are we waiting for Whitney to get there? Let me apologize when I use all of these different acronyms. When you live in this the environment that we're on with the alphabet soup, you know, you ADB, UNDP, ISLP, sorry, I would try to spell it out. The ADB was the African Development Bank, and of course, ISLP was brought forward.
Okay, good. Thank you. My name is Whitney Schneidman, and I'm representing Bob Johnson. I've had the true pleasure and honor to have negotiated two contracts in Liberia over the last 18 months. One was for the Liberia Enterprise Development Fund, a $23 million initiative, and the other was a 50-year lease for a hotel that's going to open next week, www.kendijaresort.com. You'll make reservations. It's going to be great. And that's my plug for both Bob Johnson and the Liberian government, because both negotiation processes were really quite stunning and wonderful and effective and efficient. Two questions. One is, Karen, you raised the issue of the resource curse at the outset, and Raja, you mentioned that both contracts are going to be on the, available publicly on the internet. My question goes to the backside and the utilization of these resources, and what government is going to do to show, the citizens of Liberia and other resource-rich countries how these resources are being used. Because I think what we've seen here tonight is so important, but it's only half of the equation. The other half is making sure that these resources get to the benefit of the people from the countries where they come. My second question regards the Chinese. This might go to Natty. And what your dialogue is, and Karen, what your experience is in dealing with the Chinese and bringing them into this dialogue as well, so that there can be more transparency and accountability in the many contracts that they are negotiating with African governments. Thank you.
I think both questions actually were to me.
Yeah. Yes, I believe so. If I'm not mistaken, Liberia is just...
Revenue utilization, good question. A number of things that we have done. We have began to repair the public financial management infrastructure. We now have a budget that is developed on an annual basis, and that budget itself, it goes through a budget hearing exercise. It incorporates all revenues that the government of Liberia generates from all the different sources, including concession and minerals revenues. And it goes through not only the public hearing process through the legislature, but once it is then approved by the legislature, it becomes the law. And it is the law that the executive is mandated to operate. If you've had a chance to see our budget over the last couple of years, you see that the share to health, to education, to agriculture, to infrastructure, particularly to a number of the social sectors, you see those numbers continuing to increase. The whole public financial management process, we have also now a procurement law that came into place in 2005, but we're also reviewing that law to see how we can improve on it and strengthen it. We have draft regulations that are now being developed, and we're looking at in terms of the implementation of that law. We also have concession laws that, again, were approved in 2005. And again, we're trying to see how we can improve on the law in terms of some modifications, but particularly by putting in place now the operating regulations and procedures. We have before the national legislature now a public financial management law that, again, that outlines particularly the role of the executive in terms of what its responsibilities are as far as executing the budget, as far as making commitments on behalf of the government, as far as being able to contract loans through international bodies. And once that law has been, we hope that that law will be approved by the legislature during its current seating. And then we have now to develop all of the regulations and everything associated with that. We're also putting place, we've also developed the whole auditing general functions that are now totally independent, don't report to the executive, reports to the national legislature, and there are certain mandated audits that must take place on an annual basis that is incorporated in the public financial management law of the Ministry of Finance, of the key social sector ministries, agriculture, health, education, public works. Those are mandated, will be mandated by law that those audits always take place on an annual basis. And of course, those reports, once they're submitted to the legislature, become public for review. We're developing also now the whole monitoring and compliance framework in terms of the implementation of the procurement system, the implementation of contracts and all of that. We're building the capacity within the ministries, particularly in terms of the whole internal audit function. There's no internal audit. There hasn't been an internal audit functions in many of the ministries and agencies. There are no generalized functions of accounting in many of the ministries and agencies. So all of that is in the process of being built in the country, being built. So those are the ways that we know and we are certain will ensure that the resources that come from all of these efforts eventually reach to the Liberian people and benefit the Liberian people, that every piece of revenue that is generated either directly or indirectly from all of the different sources go through the budget and nothing is expended outside of the budget. With respect to the Chinese experience and moving forward, our experience there is relatively new. We're just beginning now to engage in some of the Chinese. We've negotiated with the Chinese on this one concession contract for the Bong mines, which, quote unquote, is supposed to be worth $2.5 billion. Of course, that's $2.5 billion over a long period, and we'll have to then work through those numbers. But again, some of the same intensity that went on into some of those renegotiations were also characteristic of the negotiations with the Chinese. One of the things that we are doing, we are getting, again, as Peter has said, we have been fortunate to try to see how we can utilize the expertise of others to support what we are doing and what we have been doing. And so we're looking at now some of the experiences of other countries in working with the Chinese and the whole Chinese experience, see if we can develop some lessons learned quickly. On my journey here, I had two days of working meetings in Accra, working along with some of the members of the team that will be working on that exercise. There is some support that we're receiving, I don't know if I can say it, but from the McKinsey group that will be working along with us, looking at the experiences from other countries and how Liberia can begin to shape its own strategies and policies, negotiating on these large Chinese things. We did learn, even in the Mittal arrangement, that a lot of people expected that, well, once this is done, the hiring practice, this thing, you know, they still had memories of when the previous, like when you had Republic Steel and those people, when they came in and set up the mining something. And it was, again, a completely different formula, a completely different corporate structure. And we expect similar, so we will see that kind of situation as you negotiate with Chinese and their Chinese firms coming in. Again, there's a different corporate structure. There's a different corporate attitude. There's a different corporate framework. And to understand all of that as you do these negotiations, I think would be extremely critical as we're moving forward, and not learn about it after you have negotiated and signed the deal. So that is critical, and that's some of the work that is being done now.
Oh, thank you, Jed. Oh, sorry about that. I'm just curious to know what role, if any, the media played. Did they cover the day-to-day negotiations? Did they take positions? Did they help build pressure? Anything? Peter's smiling.
Can I say something at the beginning? Because I can only say about the early phase of the media. Just a couple of comments. One, that I think the public airing of the material in Liberia, in the newspapers in Liberia, was very important. So the Liberian press being a place where there was a debate that was open I thought was very important and valuable in the sense of this transition in Liberia. You know, and we don't talk about it very much, but the while much of the debate about this was going on, the ArcelorMittal merger was going on in Europe. And I can say that almost without exception, there was no attention by any of the major financial journalists to the Liberia situation during that time. And that was in part due to Mittal's very active efforts with their own law firm, who threatened any lawyers who did reach out. So that Dino Mattani of the Financial Times, who started to make inquiries and was planning to write, got a long letter from Mittal counsel that basically shut them up over the critical period of time when I think it could have actually affected Mittal and put more pressure on them in Europe. So I think that Mittal effectively stopped reporting on the subject during that time. Not to say that there were very many who were curious to pursue it, but I do know that the Financial Times tried.
My name is Johnny Steinberg. I'm an Open Society Fellow for this year. But what I want to ask is, I mean, getting over the resource curse, I think, for Liberia is massively, massively difficult. And I want to ask whether it is possible to build contracts that help that at all. And for two reasons. I mean, the one is that 20th century Liberian political culture was shaped by a resource curse. You know, when the country started earning money, it was through rubber and iron ore, and you know, that was the vast bulk of the country's GDP, and the revenue went to the president's office, and it was dispersed through patronage, and that's the political system that was built. You know, that's the culture that the new government inherits. And the second is that structurally very little has changed, in the sense that, as far as I understand, more than 90% of the country's export earnings now are through rubber and iron. And if that's the case, that is a resource curse. That's the definition of it. You know, it's a country with vast unemployment. And if this is the main source of revenue, it's from these industries that the revenue must be distributed in one way or another. You know, there are just a lot of structural factors demanding Liberia to replicate some of the more unstable parts of its past. And my question is it possible to design contracts which try to mitigate against that? I mean, I'm talking as an amateur, but, you know, my understanding of a contract that would mitigate against repeating the resource curse is that you can take our resources in return. You must invest in us doing other things, you know, because, you know, if that figure of more than 90% of export earnings from two industries remains, the resource curse remains. You know, Liberia surely needs to diversify if it's going to avoid the resource curse and a politics built on it. And can you build contracts that allow you to diversify, whether it be building an infrastructure for other industries? I'm not sure.
Well, let me say this, first and foremost. I'm not sure if you build contracts that try to do that, because there has to be corporations come in to do business. They don't come in necessarily to participate in doing your work. But you as a government must also identify those things that you need to do as a government from the revenue that you gather from there. Now, there are different kinds of businesses that have value chain linkages and connections upstream and downstream. And when you make the reference with respect to resource curse, over the 15 years, the entire Liberian economy collapsed. And again, one of the other graphs that I have that I also usually like to show is to show you that Liberia experienced the most severe and the most significant drop in GDP that has ever been recorded. And when you see the graph, really it's actually like standing on a cliff getting ready to take a nosedive into the water. The recovery process that is going to take place in Liberia is, first of all, you're going to have the traditional industries will come back. Those will be the first one to come back, and normally that would be the case. And so for a three-year period, what is happening is that those traditional sectors are beginning to come back because that's where the economy was. What is Liberia doing differently? As far as you make reference to that resource curse, is to begin to approach the concession industry for one completely different, particularly the iron ore mining industry. That's why during the renegotiations, a critical component in those renegotiations was making sure that the government of Liberia had the say in the utilization of the rail. okay? And that was a really, that could have been a deal breaker during on those renegotiations, because we worked around so many of the other things before we got to that. It just really kind of building the relationship going forward, because we knew that could be the deal breaker. Because in that agreement, then Mittal had to agree that that asset was not part of the concession full control, but could be used by multiple users. What that allows you to do then is to start to unpack some of that, those concessions. We have almost 200 kilometers of rail from the port of Buchanan, where the iron ore would be unloaded onto vessels to where the iron ore is produced. And along that whole 200 kilometers, there's enormous economic opportunity that's there that can take advantage of the utilization of that rail. Well, in the past, that entire rail was to the concessionaire. And therefore, the only thing that it did was to bring iron ore down and take things that the concessionaire needed up to the mines. What this new agreement does, and what our entire strategy is and policy is in moving forward, not just with the Mittal arrangement, but the other mines, is that with the rail now, it creates opportunities for the logging sector, it creates opportunity for the agriculture sector, it creates opportunity for the movement of people, it creates other potential industrial activities, inland ports, inland container ports, where, because our border with the Guinean border, there are a number of towns and cities that are near to the Liberian side of the border that can be easily accessed through inland container terminals, then you would actually be able to get goods that come into the port of Conakry that would be able to reach there. We've seen that now as we've negotiated down the arrangement with the Chinese. For instance, the development now of the hydro, we're linking the development of the hydro to the demand of the concessionaires. But we're saying that within those concession agreements, the government will have access to at least 25 to 30% of the energy that you generate. But that also has a two-way street, because hydro electricity is one of the cheapest form of electricity that you can find. The potential demand for electricity by the different concessionaires provides the potential for the appetite for then a private concessionaire to make the kind of investments in the rehabilitation of the hydro to be able to sell power then, therefore, not just to the concessionaire, but also to the national grid. And vis-a-vis places where the national grid isn't able to reach to the concessionaire, that the government then will buy at least 25 to 30% of the energy that they generate to be able to develop the communities and towns and cities that are around the concession areas. So I think quite clearly that there are a number of steps that are being taken now to address some of those things that we didn't do very well in the past, that I think there's opportunities for us to now begin to do a little bit more with them. The bulk of the thing, though, still comes to what is our development and growth strategy moving forward. And our development and growth strategy moving forward clearly recognize that you have to now move away from just concessions to other industries that does create employment. If look at what we're doing now with the logging industry and how we can begin to apply more community rights and community utilization and operations for smaller operators that have larger multiplier effects and create. And of course, agriculture is still pretty much the mainstay of where we will be for a long time, and how we invest in agriculture, because that's the mainstay for the majority of the population that's in Liberia. I will say, though, that prior to the coup d'etat that took place in 1980, there were efforts. There were lots of efforts in terms of these ADBs, these agriculture development units that had started in three counties, bringing equipment, helping farmers clear the land, providing technical assistance, providing marketing assistance, and all of that. And I would venture to say that I see efforts would probably be looking at how do you begin to put some of those things in place moving forward to support the development of agriculture. If you look at our poverty reduction strategy, for instance, the first 3 years. Where the priority is? The priority is in roads, is in infrastructure. How do we get the port rehabilitated so that it improves competitiveness for other sectors? How do we begin to open farm to market roads and all of those things? But we still have to now make the investments in the inputs to agriculture and also on the back end as far as supporting farmers getting their goods to markets and what else have you. So I hope that answers some of your questions.
I just add, as a quick follow-up, in these contracts, Natty B was right. I mean, they're business documents, and typically the companies aren't agents of social development and economic growth. But we have managed in Liberia to put in these contracts a number of things that go directly to what you're talking about. For example, in the Mittal contract, there's a community development fund for the three communities that are most affected by Mittal's operations. And those community development funds are controlled by the local communities through their representatives. We did a lot of work in these contracts to make sure that there was social benefits that didn't exist in the prior contract that now exist as a result of contract terms. But ultimately, what you're coming back to in terms of making sure that these countries benefit from these kinds of contracts is political will and vision, commitment to development. And I think for the first time in Liberia's history, we have economic growth linked to poverty reduction. And in fact, the whole contract review process is tied into the government's poverty reduction strategy. So there's a vision now that links the two. And hopefully Liberia will see better results.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Karine, for inviting me here. My name is Habib Han, and I'm from the Republic of Guinea, which is very neighbor to Liberia. And I think there are a lot of similarities between what happened in Liberia and what is about to happen in Guinea right now. Basically, there's a transition government right now in Guinea, right? And they put together sort of like the LRDC that has been created in Liberia, and which respond directly to the office of the government. I'm sorry, the office of the president, and it's called the Committee for Audit and Surveillance of the Strategic Sectors of the Economy. And basically, the role, as the name stands, it's auditing all the strategic sectors and also recuperating whatever money is owed to the government, and then thinking about the surveillance of the strategic sectors going forward, mainly mining, because as you know, Guinea has more than one-third of the world reserves of bauxite, and the second world producer of bauxite, which is used for alumina and aluminum. And I was recently asked to actually be the co-chair of that committee. So that's where my interest comes here. It happened that I'm in New York during this time, so I'm very happy to be here. I know Raja pretty well. Peter, we met in 2007 in Dakar. So I think there are a lot of similarities here, you know, because this is a transition period for Guinea as well. And I think that from a resource standpoint, Guinea is one of the richest countries in Africa as well. And, you know, the minerals are very large. You have gold, diamonds, bauxite, you just name it, even uranium. They're even talking about oil that they just found. Some companies trying to get 100% of the offshore in Guinea today. So I think the tremendous amount of work that could be done in that country as well. One of my challenges, and this is where my question comes in, how to institutionalize, right, some of those wins that those countries could get through a strong leadership. Because obviously you had a strong leadership in Liberia to be able to, you know, have that political will and look for the international support, right? Then, you know, how do you move from that leadership to the institutionalization of what has been done so that, you know, whatever changes happen can stay going forward? So how does someone do that, and how are you guys doing it today? I guess if this is something that we can learn from you. Thanks.
Wait for the book. It comes out in April. you know, seriously. I think the president hopes to launch her book in April, and I guess maybe some of that will be in there. It's critical. The political will and leadership, I think you will hear that permeate throughout, to be very honest with you. We've had a chance to be involved in a number of other sectors as well. I'm happy that you were able to make it. I would be more than pleased to be able to provide whatever information that we have available to us to share with you as to, you know, how we were able to at least get certain things done. We've had discussions. I've had discussions with the president in terms of how we could be more supportive of Guinea and Guinea's efforts in some of those areas. So that is available, and I'm sure we'll share, exchange contacts, and be able to provide all of the information that we have. But it's critical. I mean, you've heard everybody here. The opportunities are there. There are programs now that are being developed to support countries to do that. There's a lot of goodwill in the international community to work with governments in terms of doing that. We've heard that. The lawyers, the those who can do a lot of the analysis and the assessment, it's a question of the political will to use it. And that is always the big if, to be very honest with you. Maybe perhaps you can add something else.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right, Nadibi. I mean, it comes down to leadership. What are we really talking about? When we talk about leadership and political will, we're talking about a value system. And essentially, we're usually talking about, in our country, talking about a departure from an existing value system and recreating or developing a new value system. You know, the fascinating thing that's happening in Liberia is that we are now, as a nation, creating a new fabric, right? And what it means to be a Liberian, what the expectations are for citizens and government. And so I think the challenge is to look at some of the values that Ellen Johnson Sirleaf's leadership and her political courage demonstrate, and find ways to begin to build that into the larger society. Now let's talk about it in more concrete terms. In terms of institutionalizing what one person is doing, you start by building capacity. And you build capacity by sharing the values that this leadership or that leadership demonstrates. Short term, you can do it through some of these programs and projects that Karn and Peter, Natty B, Jeff, we've all talked about, making sure that within government you give opportunities to the folks who are involved in the process to update their skills, to get exposure, to get training, whether it's through workshops or whatever the case might be. Medium term, you want to expand government so that you bring in people, whether people who have been in the country have not been encouraged to participate in government or couldn't afford to participate in government, or bringing people in from the diaspora. And then longer term, you then want to make sure your educational system reflects these values so that you produce people who respond to the underpinnings of the leadership political courage that we all are saying, you know, plays a large role in this. But it's a three-step process, and it's a process that is a long-term process. And I think Liberia is, you know, we're working on the first part, which is, or maybe we're at the medium term, where we're working on capacity beyond just training people in the government. We're actually doing the recruiting opt-in program. So there are a number of things the good minister can share with you that Liberia is doing to
I wanted to add one comment, which I think that the transparency, the provision of information to the public is a very important part of this change in direction in Liberia, among other countries, in that it is probably the best guarantee that this new direction will be continued by successor governments, because when the rules are clear and public, when the contracts are public, it becomes much harder for a successor government to deviate from that path, because the public will begin to ask questions about what is happening and why. So I think the transparency component is a very important piece in this puzzle, and having a durable and successful process.
I couldn't agree with you more. I have always made that statement, particularly for instance in the budget process, and why we've tried to take the budget process not just through the budget debates that take place publicly and all of that, but then once the budget has been approved, to actually try to break the budget down in very simple terms, giving the literacy level, so people and the children in school, the children in high school and things of that nature can get copies of the budget message and the framework of the budget and know that this is the public exercise, so that hopefully if they see things beginning to work and benefits and actual services actually reaching them, that tomorrow when you have a different leadership or you have a different administration that begins to try to change that process, they will ask why. I mean, this has been working okay, it's been working for us, why is it now that you're trying to change it to do something else? And so that's very critical as you build that. And again, where we are, there's a lot of credit to a lot of people over many years. I strongly believe that it was during the earlier period, of particularly of Dr. Amos Sawyer, when he was interim head of state way in the early 90s, that began to really take that muzzle off the press. And once that muzzle had been taken off the press and they began to enjoy that freedom, when successive governments came and tried to muzzle that press, they refused to be muzzled. And that also contributed to the kind of international support there were, because they kept the issues front and center. So there's a lot of that have been done. And where the press is right now, really, yes, there's still some building and development in terms of the press and the quality and stuff like that. But the freedom that the press enjoys, I don't think now that can ever be rolled back. And therefore, that creates the space for continuing to address the value system, as Roger makes reference to.
Sure. The whole transparency point that Karen just stressed on is very, very important. And I think that having the political will is great, but also the political will supported by that transparency in the system is definitely great. The committee that I just mentioned in Guinea is also responsible of, you know, basically helping assess the value of the contracts that are out there and make sure that they reflect in international standards and that kind of stuff. And the new leadership is actually pushing for transparency to make sure that everybody's aware what is in those contracts, and publicly announce them and talk about any sort of negotiation that would be going on those contracts publicly on TV, on the radios, on the newspapers. They definitely committed to that sort of transparency in the process.
Question here, and then one in the back, and then I think we'll probably wrap up.
Thank you. I just wanted to pick up quickly, because I know the hour is late, on the capacity question that I'm sorry. Brian Fix, a lawyer, and I've had the pleasure of working with ISLP and many of you here, particularly in Sierra Leone over the past year. All of you, particularly Roger, in your response just now, talked about capacity building again, and I'd like to end on that. And I'm reminded of a negotiation in Kenya where a Kenyan co-counsel of mine said, success in a negotiation can only be measured by the ability of the government to implement the contract after it's signed. And my question specifically to all of you is, A, in either Mittal or Firestone, is there any contract administrator or administrative body making sure that the terms of that contract are being implemented on a government-wide basis? And second, having been through that and fast forward to 2009, would you recommend any changes in your contract clauses to recognize weak governance and weak monitoring and to make it more self-enforcing as time goes on?
Well, I've touched on that, capacity is very, very weak. I would say from the standpoint of being radical on one hand would be to say to government, particularly with some of the challenges that maybe perhaps that might even be something that in a short period you might even want to outsource and have some actors from in the private sector participate in that with the compliance and the monitoring part while you build that capacity. As I mentioned in my opening, while this is great, and we've done this, I'm already at the next phase, and that next phase has been our ability to really ensure that these contracts are implemented and are implemented fully. There are different activities that are supposed to happen within the agreements, and right now the different ministries and agencies, for instance, on the social benefits side, the Ministry of Health, the Ministry of Education, on the mine implementation side, I think there was reference also made to all of the environmental issues that are there. What we have to do now is to build the infrastructure to ensure that those things are being done well and being done properly. We do have a Bureau of Concession Secretariat that's currently in the government, but that Bureau of Concession Secretariat, as it was developed and designed, has focused largely just on the fiscal issues and not really on the other things. So now as we're reviewing the role of the Bureau of Concession Secretariat and particularly its role moving forward, exactly what kind of posture should there be? Should there be more centralized thing? Should there be more units within the different relevant ministries and agencies, but with some coordination that comes from the Bureau of Concession Secretariat? At this point, I can't say that we do know. We have some ideas, and we're also looking at what maybe some other countries have done to ensure the implementation of that. What we did do, at least in the METAL arrangement, once the concession had been ratified, the president did constitute a dedicated committee that we call monitor the implementation of the concession agreement, and that committee, which is chaired by the Minister of Lands and Mines, that committee meets on a monthly basis, and as members of that committee are the Minister of Planning, the Minister of Finance, the Office of the President, as well as ArcelorMittal and the Minister of Internal Affairs, and that particular committee again looks at those implementation issues and whether or not there is adherence to that. But that is an ad hoc arrangement. It's not an institutional arrangement. We're trying now to build the institutional arrangement moving forward.
Can I have one thing to that?
Add,
one of the things that any of you are out there and you're on the consumer end of foreign assistance, like myself, on negotiating a contract, is tie a chain to their ankles and don't let them get out of town until after they have finished the contract, they've done you a plain English implementation manual. Because lawyers cannot, it's inherent in the process of being a lawyer, keep it simple, not in drafting the contract. You need to have something that explains in much more ordinary language what has to be done under this contract, and never let your experts get out of town without making them do it.
Does that ever happen?
Well, the exploration regulations I'm busy drafting, I've got an associate drafting a manual to go with them. So we'll see.
We have one final question there.
Hello, my name is Patrick Chia. I'm with Realizing Rights. We do work in Liberia. One of the questions I have, I guess this two-part is for Jeffrey. Do you work with the Ministry of Lands and Mines to, they have the Liberian National Oil Company. Are they part of the Ministry of Lands and Mines in regulating that new industry? Because it's something that is brand new to Liberia. They haven't begun any offshore drilling yet, but I think it will be right now to put in place whatever regulations that will benefit the government and once again the people of Liberia. Are you working with that? And also to Peter, are there any other processes or contract negotiations in Liberia that you are involved with through Colombia?
I was asked first. I'll go first. The answer to that one is easy. No, I am not. I'm on the mining side. There is a consultant who has been retained to advise the government and the ministry particularly on this process that Raja and others have described about updating the Procurement and Concessions Act and coordinating it with existing legislation. And I know there is work in process on trying to bring the petroleum law and the concessions law together, but I'm not a party to that, and I don't know where it is.
If I can, just before Peter talk, on the National Oil Company, as it's currently structured, which of course, and there's efforts being made now with respect to the new energy policy and energy law that will make some adjustments in that, because as it's currently structured, the framework that exists now, you have the Ministry of Lands and Mines actually that's the policy arm of the government, with like a quasi-regulatory role. And then you have the National Oil Company that, again, has a regulatory role, but then a quasi-operational role. And then you have the operators. So, again, there's we're working now on at least providing a little bit more clarity on that, because when the National Oil Company was developed, under previous administrations, again, that role, I think they were looking for a role that had regulatory arrangement as well as operational arrangements. Because you have operators that are actually there that will be actually doing the exploration and the exploitation and things of that nature, then it has a regulatory but then somewhat of some quasi-operational role. But again, efforts are being made now to look at those different things within the energy policy and see how we can improve them moving forward.
Our continued involvement has been really in ad hoc collaborations with some NGOs and with government. We've been in conversations sort of ready to help out where we can, but very excited about some of the questions of monitoring implementation. And that's something where we've talked both with people in government and with NGOs about ways of helping out with that.
Yeah. Because even what is being proposed, sorry, within the Act, the Ministry of Lands and Mines, in the Ministry of Lands and Mines, the way that is structured, you have the minister, and then you have a deputy minister who actually, there's a deputy for administration and there's a deputy for lands. There is a proposal to also then have a deputy minister for energy. Okay, that will then try to drive from the policy standpoint, and then how then do you develop that entire sector? It is a new sector to us, and there's a lot of work that needs to go now in developing a lot of the different sector regulations and all of those things from that particular area.
Could I just ask one more question? Or is that...
Okay, no, please, go ahead.
Thank you very much. I've been itching to ask a question. But I'm Marcus Wandel. I'm here on behalf of the Magdalena Cooper Foundation. I don't know if any of you have heard of it, but we basically are a 501c3, and we are tasked with raising money to work on groundbreaking education initiatives for orphans and abandoned children in Liberia. And we just had a big, awesome event last Friday, in which we raised a great amount of money to pay for the first tuition-free academy, K-12 academy, outside of Monrovia. So that was my plug, since everyone's had one tonight. My initial question was similar to this gentleman in the oranges about what the quid pro quo is for these extraction companies and whether or not they're giving back as part of their contracts. But I guess since you already touched on that quite a bit, I wanted to ask about how the government and, you know, President Sirleaf's administration's investing in education on a macro level as well as on a micro level, and whether or not these any of these large multinational companies are play a part in that, in investing in that type of infrastructure, specifically education.
Yeah, they do. I think as Roger shared with you, first let me say what the multinational corporations and some of those things that are built into the agreements that they do. If you take the Mittal agreement, aside from supporting and operating some of the schools, the primary schools, primary up to high schools that are within the concession areas, guided by the Ministry of Education, of course, but they have full responsibility for ensuring that those schools operate, the teachers, the upkeep, the maintenance, and everything for the schools. Also, there are provisions within the agreement that they support the University of Liberia through, again, a lot of times within their sector, because, again, you can't say just support everybody, but, again, within the sector, supporting certain things within the sector in geology and engineering and so forth, that they make annual payments to the government for the University of Liberia. Similar so in the Firestone agreement. Firestone operates a number of different schools that are within the concession areas. They have the responsibility to provide for those schools and provide teachers and so forth. Again, though, under the guidance and direction of the Ministry of Education to ensure that correct curriculum and others is consistent. In addition to that, Firestone as well as Mittal, those schools is not just for the children of the workers of the schools, but they're for all of the children that may fall within those concession areas. Because, again, some of the concessions are particularly in the Firestone concession, there are also communities that are not part of the concession that are embodied in the concession. So there's certain towns and villages that are not part of the concession, but fit within the whole concession area, and even those communities, their children are entitled to go to those schools and benefit from those schools. That's one. From the larger macro area, the kinds of investments that we need to make in education, of course, I'm sure you can appreciate, is would probably be mind-boggling. Someone asked me, say, well, you know, exactly what does Liberia need to develop? What kind of money does it need? Tens of billions, of hundreds of billions? I said, well, modestly, at least we can try with the tens of billions. But you know, if we had when you have illiteracy rate of less than 25%, you know that you need to make massive and massive amounts of investments in education. The law requires that there is at least 25% of the budget, okay, the fiscal budget, actually should be invested in education. We haven't been able to reach to that 25% percentage as share, because then, I mean, really with a budget of just a little under $300 million, that would then carry, that would not leave much for much of the other things that needs to be done. But we've been able to increase the percentage share to education year on year. Support that we're getting from the international community, however, is in order to make sure that we maximize the input and the support that comes from the international community. We've created an educational pool fund that we have, and we're encouraging all of our development partners to participate through that pool fund. Hopefully, as we move forward, that support will be coming directly through the budget. But at this particular time, since most of the support that we're getting from the international community is not coming through the budget and coming through external means, at least now there is a pool fund in education, similar so there's a pool fund in health that we're trying to encourage all of our partners to work through. A challenge that you have when you have such large amounts that are coming from international donor assistance is different donors have different regulatory and institutional requirements, and they can really be horrendous. I mean, one government requires X, the other government requires X to do the same thing, the other government requires X to do the same thing. And sometimes that can challenge, therefore, the timeliness of the implementation of a number of different programs. And so hopefully through the pool funds, as we get to direct budget support, because again, direct budget support will probably come after we put in place a lot of the public financial management systems and all of those things there. But as we get there, we're utilizing a pool fund arrangement. And the concentration right now has been on primary education. Sometime in March, we will be having a detailed retreat looking at the 10-year capacity development plan for the country. And that 10-year capacity development plan will be looking at the whole range of things, not just capacity development for the government, but the national capacity development needs for private sector and for everywhere else, and all of the kinds of interventions then that would be necessary for us to be able to achieve that and coordinate it all the way from primary education to tertiary education to vocational training to adult literacy initiatives and the like. So
I would like to invite our panelists to make any final remarks that they may have, and then we will conclude.
I just was thinking of one thing on that last question, and all of you who wonder why things aren't happening faster or why programs aren't getting implemented to do things more. You heard Natty B mention the budget of Liberia for this year. That number is something under $75 per person for the entire budget of the government. So that puts a lot of what a government can do and can't do in this in perspective.
Couldn't put it better. and the larger challenge to that, as I share with my colleague from Guinea, the larger challenge to that is that, in addition to that, the total share of international development assistance is two times greater than the national budget. But that just about the entire component of that international development assistance is supported outside of the budget. So it's supported through a host of parallel structures that itself becomes a challenge for the government to try to keep up and stay up with. And that's why we've tried to develop pool fund mechanisms in health and education. We've developed a trust fund mechanism for addressing particularly infrastructure investments, particularly on roads and the like. And as we try then focusing building on the public financial management system, the budget, the procurement, the audits, expenditure, revenue, and so on, so that there is more confidence in the government's ability to manage and expend resources and therefore increase the appetite for having more direct budget support. On the overall, I think just in closing, again, let me just take the opportunity to thank everyone for being here and to thank all of the different people who have participated in where we have reached to thus far in terms of Liberia. I've been saying to many of the people that I've had a chance to meet over the last few days that we haven't turned the corner yet. We can see the corner, but we haven't turned the corner yet. We still have work to do to get there. But really, the kind of support that we receive from so many different quarters, one can only really continue to express thanks and appreciation that you continue to keep Liberia in your radar screen. Don't get fooled by because things are happening well that all is well. There is still a lot of work to be done and for you to keep that on the radar screen so we don't lose sight of that reality.
Very quickly, to echo what the Honorable Minister has said, Liberia certainly has benefited from international assistance in terms of negotiating agreements that have more favorable terms. The challenge now will be to turn these agreements into better deals for the country. In other words, building institutional structures that are necessary to make sure that the benefits enshrined in these agreements in order to the affected communities and to the nation generally. And to do that, it will need the continued support and help of its friends and partners.
And can I, in closing, sort of echo and support that by noting we've talked a lot about capacity building and institutions. And one of the big changes over the last 10 years has been the emergence of institutions like Revenue Watch, the strength of groups like the International Senior Lawyers Project. And I think in this time of economic downturn, it's important to keep our eyes on this project internationally and its importance in thinking about capacity building and thinking about the contracts to be renegotiated and the new contracts that are developed. So I'd like to thank and celebrate the institutionalizing and capacity building that's gone on internationally and in which Revenue Watch has played such an important role, and just hope that we see that increase as well, because it's easy to move from campaign to campaign and not to institutionalize those successes as well.
I think it is particularly important in this time of a slump in commodity prices that governments not lose sight of their longer-term interest. I think there is a high risk at this moment that bad deals will remain undone, and that governments may be so focused on the short-term financial squeeze they're feeling that they will enter into new deals that repeat the mistakes that have been made in the past. I think it's important for all of us who work in this area to keep stressing to governments that they should still focus on the fact that they are entering into contracts that may last for 20 or 30 years, and they should make sure that they are getting a better deal. And we hope that this study will help contribute to governments being able to do that. So I want to thank our panelists, Minister Davis, Jeffrey Wood, Roger Call, Principal Author, Peter Rosenblum, and thank you all this evening.